Hey, hello, Shimon Aleichem. So what's today's Shir discussion?
So I guess I had a few thoughts since last week and also chatting with some people about our conversation. So...
yeah, remember also to talk about Rosh Hashanah because it's Erev Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah. I didn't think of the... I don't have the bridge perfectly, but I have a half a bridge.
Okay.
So I think last week we were speaking about like the issue of dogma. If you don't take if you just take the results of a philosophical discussion in one culture and apply it to another one, you don't have that conversation to show your work. You have the journey, the destination without the journey. But I think like something that I realized I kept doing in the middle of our conversation was something a little broader, which is trying to figure out along the way what parts of language, the language that we use, are universal. Meaning, and maybe this goes into how, what exactly the relationship is between language and thought. And then figuring out, okay, then what are the conventional differences between different cultures and their languages? So I think that ends up being part of the question, right? So there's some things that maybe we could even say logic or some other languages that are more universal, and we can understand clearly that the differences are just differences in how they're being represented in language. And then there are some that, and then there are some things that seem to be more just conventional differences in language. I think you mentioned something about Al-Farabi had mentioned about this last week, maybe it was a few weeks ago when we were, well, I think way back when we had spoken about Al-Farabi, saying that there, some people confuse the conventional differences maybe it was grammatical differences for logical differences or something like that.
Okay, possible.
Yeah, and then maybe how I guess my bridge to it is all languages maybe having some degree of convention. What's the convention of the Torah and or whatever, I'd say religious books in general, and that's, I guess, maybe an interesting starting point for me, because I feel like I kept making that confusion last week.
Confusion?
Between when we speak about language broadly, like what are the limits of language, or what are the universal aspects of language versus the particular aspects of language, and confusing that with the differences between languages themselves. So I think, yeah, when we talk about, let's say, Greek and Hebrew, right? Greek
right.
and Hebrew, what they have all the differences, and we're trying to overcome those differences, but what underneath them is shared, I think, is also a question that maybe needs to be answered first, or...
Right, so meaning... So in other words, let's start like this. Let me think. If all we have is language, in an extreme way, in an absolute way, which seems to be what... I think what you were mentioning, I don't remember what the quote was, but this is like something that many... philosophers, ancient kind. Yeah, no, there's no philosophers that say this explicitly,
okay.
But the old kind of philosophy sees this insight as the first insight of thought, right? Could they say an uninitiated person, an unmature person, how we called it last week, is someone who thinks that his language is all there is, and therefore thinks that if... if in Hebrew they say toiv, and in Greek, English, they say good, and in Greek they say kalos or something like that. Those are different things, they're different words. Like realizing the unity behind different words is, and vice versa, right? And sometimes the same word meaning different things, like equivocal words, right? That concept seems to be very traditionally accepted as said to be traditionally the like starting point of thought. Like if you don't have thought that is free or beyond or above your language, then then there can't be any thought at all, right? That makes sense, right? It's like there are theories, yeah, there are. Again, I think it's questionable what those so-called language, 20th century language theories exactly mean, but there are theories that focus very much on there not being a way to break out of language in various different ways. And I think that like for the tradition, for the truth or something like that, that can't be the story. Like there can't, it has to be, it's true. In other words, it's true that that's how people start to think. Like if you meet someone that says the same things you say but in a different language. Now, right now we're talking in a very simple sense, right? He says literally good instead of toiv or something like that. Or he says, you know, God instead of Hashem or whatever. Assuming that these are, you know, one-to-one translations. Like there's a question if there's such a thing as a one-to-one translation. That's part of the question. But assuming that, even assuming that it was, many people would not really recognize that. So less people that cannot abstract from language, that cannot go deeper or higher or beyond three different metaphors.
I mean, does this go back to language. Thought itself? Meaning, is this also the assumption that thought is comprised of language and not that language is a way of expressing thought or a way of formulating thought?
That's what the other theory would say.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what you mean?
No, meaning if language, if these are different words between different languages, that means that they don't represent something shared, right?
The words are not shared, but the...
Oh, the underlying... Oh, we're saying the first position, assuming that they are shared.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think that we start from there. Like, mm-hmm. My discussion of such a thing would start from assuming that... I don't know if the thought is the correct term here. The reality. The thing the thought is about, right? The think thought. Not my thought, but the think thought, right?
Yeah.
The thought, what we in fancy words call the intelligible... has to be something beyond the words used to describe it. Beyond, in other words, beyond the differences between different words that can be used to describe the same thing. So in Hebrew we say yereach or levana, in English we say moon, and in Aramaic we say sihara, and in Latin we say luna, and so on. And those are all the same thing. It's just, there's only one moon called by different names. Right? This is a very important insight to realize. I guess most people did not yet realize it. We have to realize that. Like, I think it's something we should, like, I'm putting it here, like, because it seems to be something, like, I'll show you where many people didn't realize this. Now, this, like, something that's very annoying. And again, if we'll get to, like, making this complicated, we'll see that maybe there's something behind what these kind of people are saying. But it seems dumb for someone to tell you, well, when the Jews point at the moon, at the Levuna, and the Goyim is pointing at the moon, they're not pointing at the same thing. In other words, the words talking about something else. It would seem to be dumb. I think most of us think that that's dumb. While when it comes to certain other things, especially religious terms, people seem to be very confused.
Rambam spends a fair bit of time trying to dispel this confusion later now.
Yeah, and the other side of it, right? The confusion that when we say that the words mean the same thing when applied to God as mm-hmm. when applied to created things.
But it's making the same mistake in the opposite direction, meaning...
Yeah, yeah, that the word it's would...
attributing too much right. to the formulation and
that the word is the... Right, exactly. And I wonder if this would be correct, but if you look at it from the other side, you do see that, like, there's a big... there's a strong countercurrent to that, the whole first part of the Moira, because of the Rambam's very strong theory of equivocal terms, right? That the words don't mean the same thing. They seem to be the same words, the same syllables. They might even like have a family resemblance, might even be the same concept, might be an analogy. The Rambam doesn't really use a theory of analogy. He has a very like strict difference theory, right? There's only like words that mean the same thing and words that don't mean the same thing. He doesn't really have the concept of analogy. In other words, that's not an explanation. It might be something missing in his theory.
I feel like it's always a shocker, like for every first time reader of the Meira, when they open up like the first thing and all they see is synonyms, homonyms,
right,
parable.
There's a thing. And right. There's something called a parable, which we don't know exactly. Maybe mm-hmm. that's something like an analogy. But usually doesn't think of that as like the real mm-hmm. description of the reality, of the structure of what's going on. And what I'm saying is, and you could see that many people are very uncomfortable by this. And in a certain sense, the whole Kabbalah and being angry at the Rambam starts from, the Rambam said that the whatever, the yad ascribed to God is the Rambam doesn't say it's not a real thing. People think the Rambam said it's a real thing. The Rambam just says that the word yad has two meanings. One is, you know, what the esoteric meaning, one is the esoteric meaning, and those are equivocal terms, right? It's the same word with totally different meanings, and there is zero connection, zero true connection, like zero real ontological, metaphysical connection between the meaning of yad and the way we use it, and, you know, the way our language uses it, our normal language uses it, and the way the Torah uses it, referring to God. And this, for some reason, strikes many people the wrong way and makes them say, well, so therefore there's something like you're denigrating the dignity of the language of the holy text or something like that, because it seems to them that the Rambam is emptying. Of course, the Rambam doesn't say this, because the Rambam says, no, there's a double meaning, and the first meaning is just not, you're reading it wrong. But for some reason, people see that as emptying the meaning, and I think maybe the reason people see it that way is because the Rambam's very important focus is to get behind the words. He doesn't believe that words have any significance besides being a pointer to the things that they point to. Not to the concepts, because concepts are something in between words and things, and we have to talk about that. But the only point is the thing, this is why the Rambam says, for example, it's not, maybe again precise, there might be differences, but this is why the Rambam says that divine names have no power. The divine has power, and the divine activities are his power. But divine names cannot have power because words do nothing. Understanding does something, but understanding is something that refers to reality, not to the word. And again, this is something that everyone's like, well, God's name is not holy. The thing that we like makes that you agree, right? Halachically, we're not allowed to destroy and erase and all of that, but it doesn't have any holiness. It's only about what it signifies, like only the thing it signifies as holiness. That strikes many people the wrong way. And I think the Rambam would say, yeah, that's because you're childish and you have not realized yet the difference between the finger and the moon, right? The pointer and the pointee.
Well, I think some of the reason that people get disturbed by this is because there are a lot of assumptions in the terms that we use. I mean, this goes back to that dogmatic discussion from last week, which is, well, when we speak about a divine name of God, we assume that contains in it would be a bad way of saying it, but it represents the culmination of a certain idea, or this term already is backed by a certain dialogue. I'm not saying that people necessarily mean this, but I think that that's what people imply. That's why people feel attached to these terms, because God seems to carry a lot of the, we'll call it, broader Western culture with it in a way that Shem Havayah doesn't.
Okay, very good. Right. So we're.
But that's, again, a particularity, and it wouldn't give it holiness. It would just give it a certain better or more culturally descriptive reference point. But yeah, I agree that it's a mistake. I think we're usually coming from this mentality.
No, we are trying to think about this the other side. That's what you asked, right? We first say that it can't be that things are identical to words. As great as words are, they're not identical to things, and definitely not. Having two names for the same thing doesn't make it into two things, and vice versa, right? Two different things having the same name doesn't make them into the same thing. But the question is, wait, so then now there's still a previous question, right? But now there's a question here. Before we get to this question, the question that you asked first is, but does this mean that we have access to the things before the words? Right? Mm-hmm. This is the first question. Right? Assuming that there are things. If there are no things, then this question doesn't arise, because there's just no things, there's only words.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if there's no difference between, so if the and full meaning of the word Hashem or whatever is the word, then you can't have the question, does this give me access to the reality? Because that's all there is. Yes, you don't have to believe it that way, but that's a thing. But if there is a difference between the thing and the word talking about it, now we have a very serious question, both about human cognition, human understanding, human insight. Since most of us generally think with words, understand things through words, at least communicate what we know about things through words, there's a big question. How do we know that our words are about anything, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the different version of the question of, is reality really accessible to us through words? Is the world, not the words, is the world really intelligible, right?
Right. There is an epistemology question underneath all of this, which is...
That's the real question. And the question sort of can be said in both ways, and I think they're very similar questions. One is something like, so before you have a word for something, do you know it before the word? And the word is just naming the knowledge that you have of it. But knowledge is something ineffable. Now, ineffable, not in like a weird way, just in a literal sense, like it's there, and the words are naming it. Or is, in which case it's even hard to see how communication could work, because I cannot communicate to you the thing, I can only communicate to you the word, which means the moment I do that, I lost the thing in some sense, right? So then the other side, so I said the other side of the same question is, would be, or does our thought really work through words? And therefore, do words really grasp, so to speak? Do they become carriers of their things? Right, which seems to be...
I think that there is, like, I always thought that there was some even further split that could be made between how a thing comes to be known, and then once it's known, how it comes to be, I guess the process of the knowledge becoming known, and then after that reaching a point of expression. Like, I think perception, I think a lot of people seem to think, which I always feel like, at least personally, is a mistake, is that there's, if language is required for thought, then language is also required for perception. That things are perceived in their linguistic containers, or whatever you might call it, instead of language coming afterward as a way of giving expression to some idea that's understood. And I think even that can be questioned. Maybe the thing can come to be understood, and then language is just a means of transmission or just building on that idea further. But I think I think that there's maybe three stages here. There's the stage of the thing becoming known. Then there's the stage of knowing it. Then there's the stage of, I guess, building on it or expressing it or trying to fit it into terms that can be shared and in a communal language, we'll call it that particular language. Like, I think logic is the easiest thing to point to that can be like pre-thought. Like, sometimes we think in logical, we might use particular language to just play out the logical scenario in our head, but logic does seem to be prior to even thought and after perception.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's
logic is maybe the best word. I'm sure something better to describe that intermediate phase where something comes to be known before it comes to be expressible or effable or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So like something like this, maybe. It can't be the case, or at least we're not working with the assumption that it's the case, that everything is just words. That opens us to a problem, which is, so, are you seeing, let's use the word seeing, are you seeing the thing before you name it, before you talk about it, before you even understand it conceptually, right? Which seems... Is that necessary, right? Let's try to ask this question. Is that necessary? So does anyone who believes like that there are things behind the words commit themselves to also believing that one has access to things without words? Right? Now, you know, famously, everyone like in the more mystical side of things thinks this, I think. Right, thinks both that words, that there are things beyond words. There are the things. And this, by the way, just to be clear, this means all things, right? I know people like to pretend that some things are in the words. No, I mean, I guess you could say that. But if you really think about this, this means all things, or at least all intelligible things, all things that we understand. Whether this is true of like perception is another question. It might be true of that too, but we don't generally think of perception as occurring within language, within words. We generally think of that as below language, like a lower kind of knowledge. But if their point is that the thing known, the intelligible, the intellect, the whatever it is that we know when we know something, is not identical to the words in which we describe it, in which case it would have to be true also that saying in a different language would mean something different, which we don't think, then that means, like I was saying, that's something for everything. For everything known must be beyond words. Right? It's not like, this experience was beyond words. No, anything you ever understood was beyond words. Understanding is the practice of noticing things that are beyond words and then, I guess, putting them into words somehow. That is what understanding means. And there isn't any real difference between this kind of philosophy and anything that people call mysticism in that sense. And if mysticism is like standing before reality itself, before which is the reality, which is the thing that we then talk about, seems like that's what it has to be for all kind of thought, for thought about anything, or anything that can be thought. Maybe not everything can be thought, maybe not everything is intelligible, but for everything, anything that can be thought, that has to be the case. Is this true?
It would have to be the case that it can be confronted pre-language.
Yeah. Well, that's the question. I mean, like, again, so I think here there is a question. Do we say that there has to be like a moment of pre-language confrontation, beingness, or whatever words we call this? Or in which case, then we have the question, so what is the words even doing at all? Right? What are the words doing? Why are we trying to put things into words all the time? Why don't we just go around staring at the world and going, come on? And it seems to be, and of course, there are people that think that, like, stop putting things into language, since this is true. That also seems to be wrong.
How come you have to hear that?
Yeah, that also seems to be wrong, because it seems to be very obviously true that the words that we use do have something to do with revealing the thing. And possibly showing them better to us, making them closer to us, making them clearer to us.
I think also maybe something that I've noticed is a lot of people want to call something indescribable because any normal conventional language would have a very hard time using a short amount of words to explain it. Maybe you just need a lot of
words. Yeah, well, you know, right.
So I think to me the purpose of language has to be doing some degree of abstraction of what's being thought, and with every abstraction something is left unabstracted. So I think like there's this partial part where we can say, okay, I see this in front of me. If I call it a bottle, it'll have some connotations maybe that are incorrect about it. It's not quite a bottle. It's a drinking bottle or something that would probably require more expression, and maybe we'll never be able to fully encapsulate what this is with words. Right. I may not be able to exhaust what's in front of me with language, but it doesn't mean that language can't describe aspects of it. Or can't describe attributes.
Well, what I'm trying to say is either it's even worse than that, because everything must always be beyond words. Mm-hmm. And obviously we do use words, and not only do we use words, we also think, I mean, we experience the fact... I think
we use words to think it as part of the larger community of things that are like it.
Is that all of it? Because I would say that... the noticing of things itself is at least helped by words. Mm-hmm. So even the moon, as long as it doesn't have a proper name, and proper names are one very important thing we do, one of these, like, maybe like the primary instance of language, naming things, right? Because other kind of like descriptions and verbs are kind of different. But just the proper name of a thing, looking at the moon without knowing that it's called the moon, not like that Borges story where it's like the shining thingness in the highness, you know, because there was this society that outlawed proper names because everything is in flux and they don't exist. If you would have looked at it, the moon, that way, you would not see the moon. In other words, the real moon. At least this is the presumption of the people that do believe in proper names, talking about being about something, you know, in essence, since existing. So you say, when you looked at the moon, like when some primordial man, imaginary person, pre-language, you know, before the linguistic revolution and 100,000 years ago or whenever, looked at the moon, he did not see the moon. Obviously, the moon saw him, right? Meaning to say, the moon was there, nothing changed in the reality, or maybe had slightly different orbit or whatever, but nothing changed in the reality. But he didn't see the moon. This real thing we call the moon was shown to us by giving it a name and saying moon, or whatever they called it before. Some method
of distinguishing it from other white and high things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gets distinguished, it becomes trackable, it becomes intelligible, right?
Mm.
We could now understand it. We can now ask the question, okay, what is the moon? How does the moon work? What causes it to be the way it is?
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of understanding that we have about the moon, which, but again, those understanding would be like attributes, but just even the standing before the thing we call the moon seems to have been helped by having a word for it. Like if I point and I go like this.
This is again putting the language before the...
Well, this is the problem.
Before the thinking or before the perception and...
Yeah.
As a means of... Language as a means of assimilating the information.
Right. Without saying that the language is all that there is. Like when we talk about the moon, we only talk about this word moon and not about the thing in the sky. But saying that it seems that words tell us about things in the sky. I mean, that's the normal description of what words are. They're about things.
Mm.
Which is saying, yes, things are before, were be there before words, but the words show us the things. They don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't create some new thing, they show us the thing, right? And therefore, you could say, like, you know, the philosophers like Socrates was going around and trying to find the correct sentence that describes a thing, like usually something fuzzy, like the good or ethics or the good life, is trying to see the thing. He's not trying. People sometimes accuse Socrates of like ruining everything because everyone knew what everything was before you started asking us the questions, and now we don't know anything because you told us that this linguistic, like word, verbal intelligence is the most important thing, and maybe it's not. But I think that at least what he thought is that having the correct words for things, in other words, and we could argue about this, right? This is the moon. No, well, it's not the moon. It's just a planet. We have like. Is Pluto a planet? That's a real argument in this theory. Like, a planet is this kind of thing. And we can have a real argument. Is this a planet or is it some asteroid? Is it a moon or is it a... I don't know what something else we would call
asteroid.
It. Yeah. Or is it just a rock, a shiny rock in the sky? Those are two different things. And there's a true answer to this question. And giving it a proper name, moon, already somewhat answers some of that question. Like, there's such a thing, a moon, right? It's not one more... shiny thing.
Right, but I think this goes back to the conversation we had about words. Yeah, that the fact that they do have a certain history or a certain family of association or a certain...
Right, but this is before that. This is trying to like isolate.
Even when we call something the moon, we're referring to a certain prior argument or a prior discussion that existed about this, the high white thing that kept showing up in the sky every night.
Right, but I'm saying once you start talking about a culture and association, you're much like you're talking about something a lot more complicated than what I'm trying to talk about right now, or you told me to talk about.
Well, I think that this is in some sense what I think the interesting question is: at what point the shift goes from being
right? Right. So this is the question. Like, we think that the naming of things, like the like it says in Bashas Bereshis, right? God called the heaven or whatever, the sky heaven, the Kiyah Shemaim. I don't know how I just translated it. Anyways, yeah, the firmament, the spread out thing he called sky, something like that, right? No, that's literally what the Pasuk is saying. Rakia is not a proper name, it's like the spreading out, and this was
right,
called Shamayim.
Called the abundance of water, the sea.
Yeah, exactly. And And this has given us the essence of those things. So the essence was there before the word, but we do not actually see it. There isn't like a raw seeing that's before words, or at least not a very good one. I guess there's maybe some question that's before that. The existence of the thing must be before the words, but the understanding is in the words, and they must be, and that must be like a real stage, like a real thing. So it turns out that words are real things. They're not mere pointers, at least in the process of understanding, because the process of understanding is mediated by calling things names. In other words, now when we say names, we don't mean the Greek, Hebrew, English, Spanish name. I mean the naming, the definition behind the name, right? The idea of the name. But that would be a real thing, right?
So I guess, and maybe this is just pressing it a little too much, but what we're saying here is that there is a universal language of perceiving, even if it uses the we'll call it the particular word.
Right, so very good. So now we have to ask this question. So now we can ask this a third level of the same question and say, okay, so you're telling me that right, let's call this the word moon. You might as well call it the form of the moon anyways. Is doing real work here, right? Is telling us that there is a moon and what that moon that there is. And now you ask me a question, okay. And you got to there by showing me that, you know, we're always going around naming things and defining things. And it's not, there's a real thing that we're defining, but it's not superfluous, this work. Like, we do understand the things clearer and better, and they become more present to us by understanding them. Now you can say, okay, so why can we ask the same question one step further and say, well, since no human being speaks universalish, everyone speaks English or something-ish. Not all languages have an ish for some reason. Anyways, then wouldn't you say that it's important to name the moon in English or in Spanish or in Italianish? Oh, sorry. Also doesn't work. Anyways, in order to understand what the moon is, and thus put the English language all the way up at the level of form, right? And the fact that it's as a trend, and then you obviously end up with this question of translations. And you say, well, yeah, that sounds okay, let's follow that. And they say, okay, but then when I translate the English into Spanish, does it stop being the moon? Are we seeing a different moon in Spanish than in English? And you say, probably not. Again, assuming the translation is good. So then turns out the English wasn't doing anything. English isn't a real thing. There aren't really different languages. There's only one language, which all languages approximate. So at the level of the distinction between languages, we go back to the more naive theory that says that language is just a way to point at something. Or in other words, we're positing like a kind of universal language called the concepts, understandings of things. Again, you could say forms if you want, which is a universal language, which is, yes, it is there, it is said in an accidental way, like in a random way, by words that we use in each language. But everyone that uses the words in that language, nobody really thinks that it's the words and language that he uses, although we do think that the words that were the conceptual words are real. Does that work?
Mm-hmm. Right, it's funny because I always think of, like, especially now with like epistemology questions with computation and things like that, there's, I think, what's maybe interesting about language, or I think, well, at least this conversation is making me realize about language, is, yeah, the way it's made known, and the way it's made known to a person by way of perception, and the way it's made known to others through teaching and sharing of knowledge and things that are known, is that the delivery method is always going to be some degree of accident or property of a certain specific reference and culture and register. But it still allows the thing to be known directly. this goes back to like Socrates' paradox with the midwife. Was the midwife? Where we come to know the idea through maybe like a transmission that eventually becomes superfluous.
Maybe. Like there's a degree of arbitrariness or like non-significance in the way in which we get to things, which acknowledging a degree of non-significance doesn't commit me to claiming that everything is non-significant, which again is something that people seem to think because people are very bad at thinking. If the specific language we're talking about isn't real, so nothing is real. No, the thing is real, just the words they use are not real. The words are real in the sense, again, in the universal sense of real words, not in the very, very particular sense of words. And then you say, yes, that level is not important. It's important practically because there aren't any other, like there isn't a way to speak without speaking a specific language. But I think that the point, like this one would say something like this. The point of understanding a language, right, is to get at the thing that the language is about, which is not the moon all the way at the top of this hierarchy, but this, the form of the moon, right, but the concept of the moon. And everyone agrees that understanding a language basically means being able to translate it, like assuming that you know two languages, right? Nobody would say, well, I understand this, but I can't translate it. I think that usually means you didn't know one of the languages or that you don't actually understand it. Does this make sense? Unfortunately, we have a bunch of people that claim to know to speak two languages, but can't actually translate a bunch of things that they consider important from one language to another. This is what we talked about last week. And again, if you say, okay, because I don't really, I live in, you know, half of my life, I don't speak any language completely, that's fine. But if you make this into a real claim and you say, and you say, well, this is a concept that is only in that language, that I think doesn't make sense. Or at least that's the argument at this stage. You have a important question here, which is, does it make sense? Which is, how important is it to preserve specific languages, even for the people that are carrying that language? Does it make any difference?
What can a particular language contain? Meaning, we speak about, let's say, the concept of holy words and holy names and these things. To what extent is that really possible with the way, with what language actually is? Like, what do we mean when we say that there's a Lashon HaKodesh or something like that? Like, does it refer to anything? Like, does it, if it's just a convention for understanding the form of things?
Right, so one answer would be to say, The Kodesh is not in the level of the words, but in the level of the things, the words, the concepts.
Meaning, the concepts meaning the, well, let's say we're talking about words that maybe refer to things, but with certain arguments already contained in
this, that. This would be another step to add to that, right? But the first step would be to say, again, something like someone like Rambam would say, Lashon Kodesh is holy because, well, he says, because it doesn't have bad words in it, okay? Now, couldn't someone just add bad words or something like that? Yeah, but that's, so he has a definitional understanding of what the holiness of a language is, not a factual understanding. He didn't really look in a dictionary and find that it doesn't have these words, or sort of did, but of course he understands that it's, you know, languages are not closed systems. You could always add a word and then there wouldn't be Lashon HaKodesh anymore, right? So what he's trying to get at is that the holiness lies in the message, not in the form, right? In the form, not in the particular instantiation of it. So the Lashon HaKodesh is not holy in the sense of using these specific Hebrew letters. In other words, you could have Lashon HaKodesh in Greek. And if you understand anything about what's going on, that would be Lashon HaKodesh. Right? And this definitely seems to have been, you know, what the earlier, or many early Tanoim thought, that the Torah in Greek is just as holy as the Torah in Hebrew. The Tanakam and the Mishnah, whoever.
Rabbi Yossi is the one who says you can only translate it into Greek now.
No, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel.
Rabbi Shimon Gamliel.
Yeah, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said only Greek, but he's already limiting the previous understanding that the Torah was given in all languages. We talked about this different times. Things like that, right? And now, I have to make this very clear. This, what that seems to assume is that there are not anything lacking in these translations. In other words, of course, they know that no translation is going to be 100% accurate because of various limitations that different languages have vis-a-vis one another. But they thought that the holiness lies in the concepts. And as long as someone, you know, in good faith is articulating the same concepts in a different register, it doesn't make any difference. You don't lose anything. That's the thought. There can be a counter thought to this, which says, well, yes, but once you have told me that there's this level of concepts, which necessarily lives through language, now you could see that there can be multiple versions, or maybe even multiple correct, in some sense, versions of the concepts. And some of them can be better than the others. So, again, to go back to my astronomy discussion, there is a traditional counting of seven planets, and that has a certain definition, right? And people like saying, oh, it was discovered that there aren't seven planets, there are, you know, the Earth and the Sun is not a planet, and the Earth is a planet, and there is also more that we discovered, and all of that. But in a certain sense, that was not discovered. The definition was changed. I'm not getting into this discussion directly right now, but right, the seven classical planets are literally the things you look up in the sky and see moving every night. Nothing about that changed. We still can't see anything else moving in the sky. We can do some fancy calculations and figure out that there's this planet called Uranus somewhere, and so on, but nobody has ever seen it move, or even seen it with the naked eye. Generally, maybe you could sort of see it, but you can't really see it moving, and so on. So, the classical definition is still true for what it was about, right? People can argue that it's a bad definition. This would be a fair argument. You say, well, when you say these are the seven moving things in the sky, the seven planets, you're saying that they are moving, and turns out it's us that's moving, not the sun. Because, you know, we have proofs for this and arguments for this. So then your concept is wrong, not the reality. Nothing changed in the reality. The base thing that we're talking about has not changed, or our understanding of it has not changed either. But our conceptualization of it has changed. And now we're not anymore seeing seven planets circling us. I mean, we literally do see them, but we don't understand them in that way. And there can be arguments back and forth about this. Like, which is this correct? Is this not correct? For which values of correct, is it correct or not correct? So these can be different questions. If you see this as a language, right, and languages can encode things like this, right, like this is a planet, we call it such and such, or, you know, in a more ancient sense, we call this Venus, which is a goddess. We call that, you know, Aphrodite or Venus, literally, right? We call this Mars, which is another god, and so on. And then you say, no, we don't call it Mars, we call it something else. Actually, we do still call it by the name of the god, but the Getschke, right? And weirdly, nobody has ever had a problem with this in like the monotheistic context. I don't know why. there's even like an attempt. Like the Hebrew name is Madim, is also just a translation of Mars. So in any case, I don't know why that. Again, I don't know. There might be a real. It might encode a certain understanding of what a planet is. And you say, well, of course, the word is just a pointing. Yes, it's not just a pointing to that point that you see lighting up in the sky. It's a pointing to an understanding of what that thing is. Now, that understanding can be right or wrong. Or it can even be not wrong, because most of these understandings are hard to say that they're wrong. It could be better or worse, or more complete and less complete. And then you say, don't stop calling the planets by these names of, divine things. There's something very important in the fact that we call them that way. And if you're going to just start calling them something else, you're going to lose it. Or actually, probably in English, we've already lost it, because nobody really knows that Venus is a goddess or something. It doesn't really mean anything to most people. And that's probably why Jews don't have any problem saying it. Right, so that's the That's the other side of this argument. Like that we
right,
say,
like people have arguments and they say, "Oh, well, this, you know, boils down to semantics. The object then is to move beyond the semantic to the."
Right, semantics.
Semantic?
Most of the time, when people say it boils down to semantics, they're wrong. Most of the time, there's a real argument, and people don't understand that words are talking about things.
There's obviously some association that you're uncomfortable with, or some.
Mm-hmm.
Buried conclusion.
In other words, it's not true that it's a semantic question if Pluto is a planet. There's something called a planet.
Right, right.
And we have to decide what that means for real.
Yeah.
It might be less than a not very relevant question to most people's lives, but it's a real question.
Mm-hmm.
It's not semantics. It's not like we can't change
right,
the name.
Say it's convention that doesn't mean that it doesn't contain our
we can't solve the. So this is the difference.
Question,
if
right.
we change the name of Pluto to Plato, sorry, or whatever, that would be semantics. Because it doesn't. You know, a rose would be a rose by any other name. But if we say it's not a planet, then that's not a question of a name, that's a concept.
I think this is especially the case with classifying terms. So if you say a banana is not a fruit.
Right, classification is the classical thing about this, and classification is a real is trying to get at. Again, if you are a normal person that believes in universals, if you're a weirdo that thinks that everything is conventioned and pseudo, but as long as you assume that there is some meaning to the fact that some things are fruits and some things are vegetables, right? And there is, because this is just encoding, this word is of course just a word, but it's encoding, like there's different ways they grow and different things that influence them and different, you know, evolution, if you say that, or whatever. Then there's a real difference and it's a real question. And this doesn't change at all if you say it in English or in Spanish, or if you call it a different word, but it does change if you call it some words make a difference.
Mm.
Words that show concepts. And you could
that
say
arguments and conclusions to those arguments. That's what we mean by concept.
I'm not yet sure about arguments, because arguments are even more trivially connected to words
well,
than concepts.
When we say God, capital G, that contains certain arguments, namely that there's only one God, not two.
Yeah, this is right. Exactly. My friend Antonio goes on about this, that how when we translate, you know, the pagan or polytheistic gods, and with the word God, it's very confusing because they're not the kind of thing that monotheists believe the God is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why it's not clear to anyone what the debate between the monotheists and the pagans is anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, because later, of course, people do that, right? And they say, well, what you call a God is really an angel. Okay, so
the capital G God in Western culture refers to a God with also with no intermediaries, usually.
Maybe.
In the common
okay, then there's a contradiction.
Yeah.
But anyways, then there's also no angels, and you shouldn't say Mechnis Rach, but of course there are angels. Anyways.
I think this is why people sometimes find those...
Yeah, I get it.
Ideas appealing.
Yeah, I get it. I get it because that's what we think already that the word God means.
So
and that's
an
and that's
right.
I don't again, I don't think it's an argument because that's not telling you why you should think that. An argument is a why. There's a concept there. Like
right.
There's a way of organizing things which says there is everything and then there's God. Something like that. There's
I would
a conceptualization.
Okay, technical language though I would say is the result of
it might be the result of an argument. Might have been people going around arguing for this, but there, that's what I'm
so no, I'm not saying it contains the dialectic like we said.
Right.
It might contain the
it contains the result of that. It
right,
contains the,
right.
the concept that says there is
okay.
created things
yeah.
and there is God. And that's the basic categories we should be thinking about when we think of theology.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, you know, no ancient polytheist thought on those categories. And possibly many ancient monotheists didn't either, right? And that's like the thing that's so hard to get across to people. Because when you say it, they think that you're making this extremely relativist point. Like, hey, what is a God anyways? What is anything anyways? No, I'm just telling you that you got to realize the equivocation within the word God that has, of course, in the Bible, the angels are called Elohim. Like, that's right, that's the proof. But, which in English would translate as God, but it's now it's a bad translation because you can't say God, so what do you say? So we're stuck, right? But anyways... this is the kind of problems that we have. And this is where, right, and this is where you could claim that some languages are better. Like maybe if it's true that it's not proper for a person to think about intermediary beings or whatever, which I guess some people think that's what monotheism means, then it's correct that we say the word God and we don't say whatever. We write it with a capital. And all of this, because that teaches you the correct way, and to think and to say like the kind of word God that even accepts a plural is the kind wrong kind of God to think of. That would be the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore speaking, okay, this is in this language that really doesn't have a plural of gods, of God, because nobody understands what it means in the monotheistic frame, is the correct language to speak. Now, of course, you'll notice this is not a language in the sense of English or Yiddish, because you could have the same discussion in basically every language, including in Greek. There's theo and theos, like, and so on.
Deliberately, and in a way that orders them properly.
Yeah, but again, this discussion is not about language.
Right.
A language in the sense of, like, Yiddish and English.
Mm.
Right. All these languages have the same question. Does the word gods make sense in them? Right. So that's still not an argument for a very particular level of language. And I'm kind of skeptical right now that there is such an argument. Like, I really don't know. The thing that we did last week is important. But that's still entirely conventional, right? It's still saying that because you need to get the thought from where you started, don't start right away from the conclusions which are already giving you the language. You got to start from how you think in your language. But if you have, according to that, it still makes no difference if you've been born somewhere else, you would do the same exact thing. It's just the question of you have to do it in your way because of you being born there by chance, right? By whatever it is that's responsible for us being born in specific places in specific ways.
I think it's also like interesting because a lot of the discussion around language, especially like in contemporary linguistics, seems to surround the question of how language is acquired. But to me, the acquisition of language is always just going to be the convention. Like, it's like what we've mentioned about philosophical maturity. The conventions are always going to be the assimilation of language always has to start with the very brute conventions and then work its way towards,
like, the universe,
the higher or more conceptually advanced.
But do you mean like even the more basic things, like how a grammar works and things like that?
Right. Yeah. Somewhat, I guess. Probably outside the scope of realizing I'm creeping outside the scope of our.
Right, because that's like there are objects and actions in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We call them verbs and nouns. Is that a real thing? Nobody knows, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what language teaches you? Yes, basically all languages teach you that, besides for Borges, theoretical language.
Yachas Rosh Hashanah, we spoke. I think the implication is at least somewhat implied from.
Yeah, I don't have patience, I'm tired now. The point is that the implication is that all good things are true for everyone, but not everyone knows. Like, that doesn't mean that everyone knows the good things. Does this make any sense?
Well, I think this is also probably a bigger discussion of how mistakes come to happen in understanding and disagreements. Like, if everything is like, what is a mistake or a disagreement that is zero sum when
some people are wrong? No, because why can't you could be wrong in every language too? I mean, what's the big deal?
The misunderstanding comes. At what point is this misunderstood? At what point is the mistake made? Is the mistake a mistake in conventional language? Is a mistake just a misapprehension of reality? And if so, how is that? What allows that misapprehension to take place?
I guess we'll find out another time.
And language, yeah. Okay, I think this was.
That's the story for now.
Yeah. Until next time.
Yeah. Okay. Did it make clearer what we just?
I think
last
so.
Week?
I think clarified from last week some of the.
Okay.
Some of the, at least for me, like I realized I was listening to it again and missed.
That's
at some point I.